Morning, everyone. If I haven't met you, my name's Matt. It's great to see you here. If I haven't met you, I'd love to meet you afterwards. I'll sort of hover around the back, so come and say hi. We have been, for the last couple of months, we have been in a series where we've been working through particularly the Gospel of Matthew, the life and teaching of Jesus, and it's been wonderful to revisit that. And today we come towards the end of that story. The next couple of weeks we're going to conclude that series, and we come to the part of the Bible that is known as the Passion Narratives. This, of course, is the account of the crucifixion of Christ. One of the problems that we encounter, I think, particularly as Christians when we come to this, is the obstacle of familiarity. Of course, crosses are ubiquitous all over the world. We see them everywhere. They're at the top of churches. They're the standard symbol of the Christian faith. But it wasn't always the case, actually. In fact, it wasn't till quite late that crosses began to be used. In fact, the oldest image of the cross in Christian art is this image here, which is from around 600 AD. It's amazing that it's 600 AD is when you have the first depiction of Christ on the cross. I may say, looking, however, fairly serene. You don't get images of Christ on the cross visibly suffering until a very important painting, actually, by an artist called Cimabue, towards the end of the 1200s, this image here. So these sorts of images are familiar to us now, but it was not customary to portray Christ this way. This is the first time he is seen as being visibly in pain on the cross. So that's amazing, isn't it, that it took so long for this symbol to sort of take hold. And I wonder if you can imagine why that would be, why it would take so long for the cross. Why wasn't that used from the start? Because, of course, Paul says, I desire to know nothing when I was among you but Christ and him crucified. He talks about the centrality of the cross, right? So it was there in the theology and the message, but I wonder why the symbol was not put out there. I wonder if you can imagine why that would be. Well, of course, it was because there was so much trauma associated with this symbol, because it wasn't just a symbol. It was an instrument not only of execution, it was an instrument of torture, actually a very terrible kind of torture. But even more than that, and I think this is the thing that I want to focus on today, it was an instrument of humiliation. It was designed not only to inflict maximum pain, but to inflict abject humiliation on the victims. This is why when Paul writes about Christ who came to us, who was the very image of the invisible God, the very incarnation of the invisible God, why he says in Philippians chapter 2, he says, being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness and being found in appearance as a man. He humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. And the idea there is that that's about as bad as you can possibly imagine. The cross initially was a symbol of shame. It was a symbol of shame. And what Jesus does on the cross is that he bears our shame. And I want to talk about this today. I want to dig deeply into this thing that we call shame. One of the problems we have, because it's a familiar sort of word, it's a very familiar word. Unfortunately, our culture as it is doesn't quite have a framework within which to understand exactly what shame is. For that reason, I've used before, and I'm going to use again this morning, this what I call my double axis model, to try to open up our worldview a little bit and to help us to explain a lot of terms that really don't make sense unless we have a bigger worldview. Now, most human experience is mapped on a horizontal axis between pain and pleasure. That's where we map our experience. We map our well-being. It's either physical or psychological pleasure or pain. And that's, in a sense, we don't have the framework within our, let's call it a secular culture, to really validate anything more than purely psychological or physical pain, because we just have that flat horizontal axis. But there's this whole other aspect to reality, and therefore this whole other aspect to us, that can only be mapped on a vertical axis, sacred to profane. We were created sacred children of God. And there is a sacredness to human identity that is actually unique to the biblical message. This is unique to the biblical message. There is no higher view of humanity than there is in Scripture. We are the sacred, sacred, precious children of God, created for a sacred purpose. As I've often said, being sacred means, if something is sacred, it means you can't just do whatever you want with it because it's set apart for sacred purposes. And if you take something sacred and you turn it into an object, that is, you treat it like something profane, and the word profane means like just an ordinary object. To take something sacred and to treat it as profane is to commit an act of desecration. That doesn't mean that the sacred thing ceases to be valuable or sacred, but there's a terrible act of desecration. And this is part of human experience. In fact, I'd go so far as to say this is actually the most painful experience that human beings can have, is this deep act of violation of something sacred. The sense that something sacred has been violated. But the problem is, in our culture, we don't really have a framework on which to validate the fullness of that pain. Because we have this experience and we know there's a sense of sacredness to human being. Any parent here knows that when you look at your children, you know that their value cannot be quantified. There is something infinitely sacred about that precious, precious human being. And in fact, love, this is what love is. This is where, you know, depending on your reality framework, it even changes the meaning of words. On a flat framework, love is just purely a preference for something. But that's not what love is in a biblical scheme. To love someone is to recognize and honor the sacredness in that person. And the sacredness comes from them being created in the image of God. See, you know this. You know this. Deep down, you long for this, this sense of it. There is nothing more important to children than being loved, than gaining and understanding a sense of their infinite value as human beings, not an instrumental value, not as objects, not associated with what they achieve. Unfortunately, there's way too much of that in our culture, that your value is associated with what you do, what you achieve. And it's terrible because we're worth so much more than that. We experience this. But we also experience it in negative ways. And if we can just go back to that image. When we have this experience of desecration, when we fall to the bottom of that vertical axis, when we have experiences that take us, in a sense, to the bottom of that vertical axis, we experience what I'm going to call shame. Now, I could just use the word guilt, and I'm going to make a distinction here between guilt and shame, because guilt is when you are the one that commits the act of desecration, but shame actually can happen in two different ways. Shame can occur
when you do the wrong thing, you take what is sacred and you do the wrong thing with it because you are set apart for sacred purposes. So there is an act of desecration when you do the wrong thing. But there is also an act of desecration that does not make a person culpable, that is does not bring guilt, whereby you are actually treated as an object for someone else's purposes in some way. And this can get really bad when there's a sense of violation. A lot of abuse is experienced here when you are treated as an object for someone else's gratification in any kind of way. And what occurs there is a deep experience of shame. It's a shame that isn't associated with guilt, but it can actually often cause behaviors, because what happens when there's been this act of desecration, when we're treated as an object, we can start to believe that about ourselves. You see, a lie takes hold, and then we start living a life as though we are just mere objects. We lose a sense of our infinite, sacred value. And there is actually nothing, and this is a big statement, but there's actually nothing more important than what sits at the bottom of that vertical axis. This is a very, very painful experience. Thanks, you can put that down now. It is the most painful of all experiences. In fact, it's so painful we rarely experience it in its fullness. It's so painful, in fact, in cultures that have no framework of, that have a bigger world framework, but don't have a sense of the sacredness of humanity. What forms is these honor, what's known as honor shame cultures, right? Where the only way that you can gain a sense of value, which we all desperately need a sense of, is to gain honor in some sense. And that can be, I mean, in a sense, our culture is becoming a honor shame culture. The only way to gain a sense of value is, you know, is to achieve and do and gain things, and things that reflect your value. But as a testament to how painful it is, this experience of shame, it was interesting. I was chatting after I brought this message at Moolap last Sunday. Phil Short, who's been working as a missionary for Phil and Carol for 50 years in Niger, in Africa. And he said that amongst the Fulani people, there was a time when there was a drought, and lots of the Fulani men actually lost all of their cattle. And because it was such a dishonor, because their sense of value came from what they owned, the experience of shame was so great that they actually took their own lives by throwing themselves down wells. Because shame for them was worse than death. I think it was Neville and Elizabeth, who were also missionaries actually in northern Iraq, were telling me that about families who, when the children brought shame upon the family, rather than bear the shame, they would kill their own children. This is, I would go so far as to say that shame is a kind of hell. But it's a hell from which Jesus came to save us. You see, he came and he did what he did. He who was most sacred, he who was most sacred came to absorb the fullness of our experience of shame so that we could be released into the joy of his love. So that we could know again, so that we could be reconsecrated. Consecrate means to be restored. This is how much he loves. This is how valuable we are. That Christ came to absorb our shame so that we could be reconsecrated to him. And so all of the scriptures, it's interesting when you read through the passion narratives, the thing that is emphasized, it's interesting that the crucifixion itself gets one brief mention. It's not described. I mean, look, everyone at the time would have known. There was no need to describe it. They would have all known what that meant. But the thing that's emphasized is the shame, the humiliation. And in fact, in the prediction, in this stunning prediction, actually, in the prophecy of Isaiah, this is also the thing that is emphasized, that the one who was most sacred is marred beyond recognition. Let me read it to you, because this is a stunning prophecy of what the anointed one of God would come and do for us. In Isaiah, starting in 52, verse 13, it says, "See, my servant will act wisely. He will be raised up and highly exalted." He will be raised up, it says, and highly exalted. Of course he was, because he wasn't just crucified, he didn't just die, he rose again and ascended into heaven and is seated at the right hand of God the Father. But it says in verse 14, "Just as there were many who were appalled at him, his appearance was so disfigured beyond that of any human being, and his form marred beyond human likeness, so he will sprinkle many nations, and kings will shut their mouths because of him. For what they were not told, they will see. And what they have not heard, they will understand. But who has believed our message? To whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? He grew up before him like a tender shoot, like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him. Nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by mankind. A man of suffering, familiar with pain, like one from whom people hide their faces. He was despised, and we held him in low esteem." Do you get the theme here? But surely, he took up our pain. He bore our suffering. Yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to our own way. But the Lord has laid upon him the iniquity of us all. And this is what is happening here in Matthew chapter 27. As we read this account, and the context is already one of shame, in the sense that Jesus has been betrayed for money. He has been sold for money. Talk about a desecration. Talk about a profanation of something sacred. And then people have chosen Barabbas, a murderer, over him. And then he has been flogged severely, marred beyond recognition. And then it says this in Matthew 27. "Then the governor's soldiers took Jesus into the praetorium, and they gathered the whole company of soldiers around him. They stripped him and they put a scarlet robe on him, and then twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on his head. They put a staff in his right hand. Then they knelt in front of him and they mocked him. 'Hail, King of the Jews,' they said. They spit on him. And they took the staff and they struck him on the head again and again. And after they had mocked him, they took off the robe and put his own clothes on him. Then they led him away to crucify him." In 35, verse 35. "When they had crucified him, they divided up his clothes by casting lots. And sitting down, they kept watch over him there. Above his head was placed the written charge against him: 'This is Jesus, the King of the Jews.' Now two rebels were crucified with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, 'You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days. Save yourself. Come down from the cross if you are the Son of God. Exactly the words that Satan spoke to him. Matthew chapter 4 in the temptation in the desert. He's coming back here for another go. If you are the Son of God. In the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law and the elders mocked him. He saved others, they said, but he can't save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross and we will believe him. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he wants to. For he said, I am the Son of God. In the same way, the rebels who were crucified with him also heaped insults on him. Do you see what's happening here? He is being shamed. That which is sacred is being desecrated. Why? Well, the answer was given hundreds of years before. He took up our pain. He bore our suffering. By his wounds, we are healed. Folks, the magnitude of this act of the most holy God, the magnitude of this, of what happened here. Let's not allow ourselves to become used to this. And given the magnitude of this, one of the greatest tragedies, given the magnitude of what Jesus Christ did to lift us out of shame, is that having done this, so, and I know this as a pastor, I know this from so many conversations that I have had, that so many people, even those who are believers in Christ, are still paralyzed in shame. Still paralyzed in shame. That is the greatest tragedy. And I wonder, why is that? Why are we still holding onto this shame? This sense that I'm just not good enough. I can't be used by God because I'm just not good enough because I fail again and again and again. Because, you know, because I feel so unacceptable. All of which he knows about you. And yet we still hold on to that. I think one of the problems here is that we insist on sort of dealing with this ourselves. I'm just going to kind of deal with this. And in fact, part of the problem here is that the experience of shame is actually so deeply traumatic. We have almost automated ways of anesthetizing this pain that we often don't even know we're doing it, right? And therefore, because we're doing this thing, we're kind of dealing with it in our own ways, it just remains there under layers and layers and layers. It could be that, you know, we're trying to desperately achieve things and do things and please people to try to make ourselves feel acceptable. And we build layer and layer and layer, trying to find a sense of our dignity. In all the different ways that we do that, we anesthetize this deep, deep pain within us. And the problem with that is that when you layer it under and you push it down into a dark, dark place, man, you know, when you push your shame into that dark place, let me just say, I'm not going to go a lot into this, but bad stuff grows there. Bad stuff goes and lives in those locked, dark rooms. It's often what you don't know about yourself that controls your life. And Jesus came into the depths of human experience, knowing that you do it again and again and again, knowing that you have fallen so far short, knowing that you feel completely unacceptable. This is why he came, to lift you up out of that. But you need to be prepared to sacrifice all of the layers, all of the things that you're doing to try and layer over that. You need to allow yourself, in other words, to feel the pain of your shame, to let it float, to the surface to recognize it. It's probably motivating a lot of what's going on in your life. I mean, in fact, man, I don't want to dig a deeper hole here. I feel like I'm digging a very deep hole. There's good news here. But listen, it's actually so traumatic. This is one of the key things that gets passed down for generations. Shame is a multi-generational experience. It's quite possible that part of what you're dealing with, part of what you're trying to make yourself feel acceptable is because this sense of shame, this desperate need to make yourself acceptable is something that has been passed down. It's like a trauma that's passed down for generations. And Jesus wants to save you from that. How much does he want to save you from that? Think about the magnitude of what he did. This is exactly why he did what he did. Exactly why. Because all of that experience he took upon himself in your place so that you could receive the honor of being a child of God. The writer of Psalm 3 says, "You bestow glory upon me and you lift up my head." And today I believe that the Lord wants to bestow glory upon you and lift up the heads of those here today who are suffering under layers and layers of shame. The most profound experience I ever had. And this goes right back. In fact, this is the thing that really led to my understanding, turning to Jesus and even understanding Jesus in the first place, was a deep, deep experience of shame. It was so pronounced actually at the time. I can remember to this day, it was like I had, oh man, it was like I had hell within me. I mean, I know I keep using that, but I don't know any other way to explain this. And I, with very little knowledge of I never quite understood what the whole Jesus thing is about, but as God brought this pain to the surface and allowed me to feel what was actually there, as he caused the anesthetics to subside and like point, this is what's there, this is the problem. And as he allowed me to feel that, man, I called on the name of Jesus. And I'll never forget it. Because in the moment, he lifted all of that shame off me, and I have never experienced such joy in my entire life. I have never experienced such joy, because joy is the love of God. Joy is knowing. Joy is knowing that you are so loved and sacred. And it grieves God when he looks down upon you knowing that you don't know that, not in the depths of your being. And he wants you to know that. And whoever calls in the name of the Lord will be saved.